Good afternoon, everybody, and Kathy, thank you for that very warm introduction. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I hope you've had two very stimulating days of discussion. When I was first invited to speak at this conference, the suggested topic was opportunities and challenges for market-based financing. And I was really pleased to be able to accept the invitation because this is an incredibly important topic. It's also a highly relevant topic at the moment, given the Australian government's recently commissioned inquiry into the Australian financial system. And I thought it might be useful to start off with a quote from the final report of the previous inquiry into our financial system, the Wallace Inquiry, which handed down its findings 17 years ago. In particular, the Wallace Inquiry concluded, and here I quote, "The evolution of financial systems has been characterized by a continuing struggle between financial intermediaries and financial markets." Now, while the inquiry was quite careful about drawing precise or making precise predictions, there was quite a strong sense in the final report that financial markets would inevitably win this struggle, that over time, markets, including the bond market, would become increasingly important in connecting savers to borrowers. It was thought likely that improvements in technology and access to information would allow better and more differentiated pricing of risk, and that this combined with increased household savings in super funds and a shift in investment preferences would give markets the edge over traditional forms of intermediation, namely the banks. Well, while we've seen some steps in this direction, including the financing of mortgages in the RMBS market, things haven't exactly turned out this way. Improvements in information technology have greatly improved access to information. However, the challenge turned out not to be in accessing the information, but in using it well. It also turned out that households' investment preferences didn't change that much, and to the extent that they did change, they were mainly reflected in an increased appetite for equities. And as a result, market-based financing has developed over time. It has not, though, grabbed the upper hand, as many thought likely at the time of the Wallace Inquiry. So now, one area that has attracted considerable attention is the corporate bond market, and some commentators have lamented the fact that the Australian market has not developed more rapidly, with most business borrowers still connecting with savers over the balance sheets of financial institutions. Some of these same commentators have also lamented the fact that super funds, which they see as natural buyers of corporate bonds, seem to have had only a limited appetite for these bonds. But given this background, I thought it would be useful this afternoon to briefly discuss recent developments in the Australian corporate bond market, as well as the role that superannuation funds have come to play in intermediating between borrowers and savers. And I'd then like to discuss the role that market-based corporate financing can play in providing a form of insurance against stresses in the banking system and the possibility of a lack of competition in our banking system. By international standards, the Australian corporate sector makes relatively little use of the bond market, especially the domestic market. And I have a few charts here. As you can see, since the mid-2000s, average annual bond issuance by Australian corporations has been the equivalent of just under 1% of GDP, with around two-thirds of this issuance taking place offshore rather than in the domestic market. In most other countries with which we like to compare ourselves, the corporate sector makes much greater use of the bond market. The relatively high reliance of Australian issuers on the offshore market is evident in these data on the composition of corporate bonds outstanding. Currently, bonds that were issued offshore account for around 80% of the outstanding value of bonds issued by Australian-based corporations. A decade ago, as you can see, this figure was considerably lower at around 50%. The offshore market is favoured by companies that want to raise foreign currency funding as a natural hedge against their foreign currency revenue, and it's also proven easier to issue large amounts and at longer tenors in the offshore market than it has in the domestic market. I think another perspective on these recent trends can be seen by looking at the data on the number and credit ratings of the individual bonds that have been issued both domestically and offshore. And you can see these data in this chart. There are a number of observations that stand out. The first is that the number of Australian companies issuing bonds is actually quite small. On average, over recent times, only around 30 bonds have been issued in the domestic market each year, and there have been just a few more issued in the offshore market. In terms of size, offshore issuers tend to be substantially larger, and they also tend to have longer maturities than those bonds issued in the domestic market. The second observation is that during the global financial crisis, issuance of bonds in the domestic market all but ceased. There were only a few companies going to the market in 2008 and 2009. During this period, there was some issuance in the offshore market, although the number of bonds issued was substantially lower than it was before the crisis and since the crisis. And this partly reflects the very high spreads that were being demanded by the market at the time. The third observation is that there was significant issuance of AAA securities in the domestic market prior to the crisis, although these securities were credit wrapped by the bond issuers, by the bond insurers. During the crisis, most of these insurers were wound down following large rating downgrades, and this segment of the market has disappeared now. The fourth observation is that, at least according to the publicly available data, not a single corporate bond with a credit rating below BBB- has been issued in the domestic market. You see in the bottom left-hand corner there. In contrast, since 2000, around 30 bonds rated below BBB- have been issued in the offshore market by Australian corporations. And the fifth and final observation is that there has been a pickup in the number of and the value of BBB-rated issuers in the domestic market in the past couple of years. Last year, a total of 16 BBB-rated bonds were issued in the domestic market, the highest on record. And another positive sign, the average maturity of these bonds has also been noticeably longer than it was in previous years. Now, putting all this together, the Australian corporate bond market's relatively small in size, and it is less well-developed than corporate bond markets in a number of other countries. Total outstandings in the domestic market amount to around $50 billion, compared with total corporate debt outstanding of $920 billion. Notwithstanding this, regular activity is occurring in the market, and it's occurring across much, although not all, of the credit spectrum. And over recent times, issuance appears to have picked up a little, particularly for the lower-rated companies. I'd now like to turn to the issue of superannuation funds and their role in the provision of market-based finance. This is obviously an important issue given, as you can see here, there's been a substantial rise in the share of national savings that's been managed by the superannuation sector. In the late 1980s and the early 1990s, a little less than 20% of the flow of new national savings was being directed into superannuation. Today, the figure's almost double that, as you can see. According to the latest data, which you can see in this chart, superannuation funds currently hold around $7 billion of domestically issued corporate bonds. This represents around 15% of the total outstandings in the domestic bond market, with Australian mutual funds and non-resident investors together holding a further 60% on issue. All up, domestically issued corporate bonds account for less than 1% of total superannuation assets. Now, one reason that's sometimes given for the superannuation funds' relatively limited holdings of corporate bonds is that these funds have a strong preference for equities. Currently, around 50% of Australian super's assets are invested in equities, whereas in many other countries the comparable figure is less than 40%. This apparent preference for equities is only a partial explanation at best, however. Australian superannuation funds do hold a very large portfolio of fixed income securities. However, within this portfolio, there are just not many fixed interest securities issued by the corporate sector. In contrast to only modest growth in holdings of corporate bonds, superannuation funds have purchased very large volumes of bonds issued overseas and by authorised deposit-taking institutions in Australia. And you can see this in this chart. Indeed, superannuation funds' holdings of bank bonds have risen from around $8 billion a decade ago to around $40 billion today. And this suggests that the issue is not so much a lack of appetite for bonds per se, but rather the relative risk return and liquidity characteristics of the corporate bonds that have been on offer. Interestingly, super funds have also purchased very significant volumes of bank liabilities other than bonds, including bank equity, bank short-term debt, and most notably, as you can see here, bank deposits. In fact, bank deposits have been amongst the fastest growing asset class for the superannuation sector over recent years. And as a result of these developments, super funds currently hold $440 billion of liabilities issued by banks. That represents 15% of the banking sector's total liabilities. So as things have turned out, super funds, rather than financing the corporate sector directly, have helped finance the banks, which in turn have financed the corporate sector. In effect, we have seen a lengthening of the chain of financial intermediation, from savers to super funds to banks to borrowers. This isn't quite the type of financial disintermediation that some had expected a decade and a half ago. Now, superannuation funds have nevertheless been a very important source of market-based funding to the corporate sector, but through another channel, namely through the purchasing of corporate equity. As you can see here, over the past decade, super funds have increased their net investment in Australian equities by the equivalent of around 2% of GDP per year, which in current dollar terms is equivalent to an annual net new investment of around $30 billion. And this suggests there is not a natural reluctance by the superannuation sector for corporate exposures, but rather that equity represents a more attractive option than debt. In this context, one issue that is worthy of further analysis is that of liquidity. Given that balances in super funds are essentially at call and can be moved at short notice, the superannuation funds need to ensure that they remain quite liquid at all times. This inevitably reduces the attractiveness of illiquid assets like corporate bonds. And from one perspective, it does seem slightly curious that long-term retirement savings can be moved at short notice. Over time, there may be benefits in exploring other arrangements that are more conducive to investments in illiquid assets like corporate bonds and infrastructure. Now, with these facts as background, I'd like to pose the question whether really any of this matters. Does it matter whether or not we have a corporate bond market, and does it matter what the size of that market is? After all, the Australian economy and financial system performed very well over the past two decades, and there does not appear to have been systematic difficulties in the corporate sector gaining access to finance. In answering this question, I think it's useful to think about the implications of the corporate bond market for both the overall stability of the economy and for the efficiency of financial intermediation. So in terms of stability, one of the arguments in favour of a vibrant corporate bond market is that it can effectively act as a spare tyre. If the banking system gets into difficulty, the bond market can take its place in providing credit to businesses and thus allowing the economy to continue operating normally. The available international evidence is broadly consistent with this argument, although the transition from bank finance to bond finance in times of stress is rarely a seamless one, given that the events that cause problems for banks also cause problems for markets. Nevertheless, in severe downturns, markets do seem to recover more quickly than banks, which, because they're highly leveraged, can find it difficult and time-consuming to get back to normal operations. Interestingly, the evidence also suggests that during mild downturns, banks tend to be more stable providers of credit than are markets. This partly reflects the tendency for banks with long-term clients to keep supporting those clients if they can, whereas markets can abruptly shut for a time. And the recent experience in the US and Europe provides an illustration of the constructive role the corporate bond market can play during times of stress in the banking system. Banks in these areas have been capital constrained, they faced higher funding costs, and they've had a diminished appetite for lending. And as a result, at a time when bank credit outstanding has been unchanged or declining, as you can see in this chart, the outstanding value of corporate bonds on issue has been rising. That's most obvious here in the United States. In terms of efficiency, the bond market can play the role of the competitive edge, ensuring that banks do not charge too high a price for financial intermediation. And we saw a clear example of this here in Australia in the 1990s. On that occasion, mortgage lenders were making very high returns on new mortgage loans, the spread between the mortgage rate and the cash rate reaching around 4.75 percentage points. And the RMBS market emerged partly in response to this, and over time, the extra competition did lead to mortgage spreads falling very considerably. More broadly, the corporate bond market can improve the overall efficiency of the financial system through offering a broader range of maturities and loan structures than banks are able or willing to do. So, in effect, the bond market can be seen as providing a form of insurance, ensuring that in times of banking system stress, the process of financial intermediation can continue, and at other times, ensuring that any lack of competition in the banking sector does not lead to excessively high prices for financial intermediation. Importantly, to play this role, the corporate bond market needs to be able to come to life when it's most needed. When it's needed as the spare tire, or when it's needed to provide competition. Now, in a perfect world, the corporate bond market would be deep and liquid at all times. But I don't think this is required for the market to actually play this important insurance role. Indeed, what is needed is that we have the general infrastructure that would allow the market to respond as necessary. And here I think Australia is pretty well placed. The legal apparatus exists to issue corporate bonds. The trading arrangements are well established. We have a reasonable number of financial institutions that are able to assist companies in issuing bonds. We have businesses that have experience in the market. And we have superannuation and other funds that are willing to purchase bonds at the right price. This financial infrastructure means that we can have some confidence that there is the capacity for the corporate bond market to fill this important insurance role. From this perspective, the fact that over recent times the corporate bond market in Australia has been relatively subdued compared with the markets in Europe and North America can at least partly be explained by the different outcomes in the banking sector. In Australia, our banks have been in sound shape and they've been willing to lend. In contrast, many of the North Atlantic banks have had severe difficulties and have had little appetite for new loans. Indeed, lending rates charged by euro area banks have often exceeded the cost of bond market finance for even fairly lowly rated companies. You can see that in this chart. In this environment, it's hardly surprising that bond issuance in both Europe and the United States has been quite strong. In contrast, in Australia, while a rise in the cost of bank funding has meant that some businesses have been able to raise funds in the bond market more cheaply than obtaining a bank loan, the number of businesses that have found themselves in this position is relatively small. So by and large, the Australian banking system has been able to meet the financing needs of most of the corporate sector. If we look forward, we need to ensure that this infrastructure that supports the corporate bond market remains in place, and it's strengthened over time. This strengthening is a gradual process, and there have been some steps in this direction recently. These include the efforts to simplify prospectus requirements for retail vanilla bonds and ease the personal liability of company directors, the improvement in market transparency through the RBA's publication of new measures of corporate bond yields, the lengthening of the government bond curve, and the listing of certain fixed income securities on the Australian Securities Exchange. And these are all welcome developments. So to finish off, let me try and briefly summarise the main points. Bank-based finance does remain the dominant form of finance for most Australian companies. Superannuation funds have been prepared to finance banks and have effectively outsourced the credit assessment function for much of the corporate sector. And partly as a result of this, the development of a deep and liquid corporate bond market is still a work in progress. But an equally important observation is that we do have the infrastructure that could support a strong and very active bond market in times of stress or inadequate competition. In this way, this infrastructure provides a form of insurance for us all. We need to make sure that we nurture this infrastructure so that we can continue to be confident that the corporate bond market will be there when it's most needed. And from this perspective, I think it's probably better to think of markets and institutions as being complements rather than as being engaged in some type of struggle for supremacy. So thank you very much for listening, and I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any. Thank you.
So do we have any questions for Philip? No, but yes, a question at the back.
Sorry, Dr. Lowe, my name is Brenda Quek, I'm from Fairfax Media. In December, when the Australian dollar was at 91 cents, the Reserve Bank said the currency was uncomfortably high. Do you still think the Australian dollar is uncomfortably high now?
We're quite a long way off topic, but I will answer your question. For much of the past 2 years, the Australian dollar was very high, and it was understandable why it was high. We had a record terms of trade, and the business investment ratio as a share of GDP was at the highest level in 100 years. And as the bank has said many, many times, the exchange rates played a very important stabilising role, and it did that through the peak of the resources boom. But over the last 2 years, the terms of trade have come off, and the prospect for mining investment has declined, and the mining investment as a share of GDP is obviously going to decline over the next couple of years. And the point that we had been making for some time was that if the exchange rate is to continue to play a stabilising role, which it had done so successfully for 30 years, then it would need to come down in time. And we were drawing people's attention to that relationship. And in time, the market did adjust and the exchange rate has obviously come down. So that's the broad context in which we've been talking about the exchange rate. It plays a stabilising role, a very important stabilising role. It went up when the terms of trade were high, investment was very high, and it needed to come down when the terms of trade declined, investment came down, and it's doing that.
Okay. There's another question from the back.
Daniel Sheen from GRC Professional Magazine. Another slightly off-topic question, I'm afraid, but just interested in your current thoughts on house prices in the capital cities, and are you considering macroprudential instead of rising rates to cool them?
Well, it's clear that in Sydney in particular, but also in a number of other cities, the house prices have been rising. Now, of course, this is part of the monetary transmission mechanism. when you have low interest rates, it makes it cheaper for people to borrow, and people do that, and it pushes up house prices. And the benefit that we get from that is that stimulates housing construction, and that certainly seems to be what has been happening. So from that perspective, the rise in house prices is a normal part of the transmission mechanism. I think the concern would be that if the rise in house prices generated speculative buying by people who thought that house prices would always go up. And clearly that's not the case, and we've seen house prices come down a couple of times in the last 4 or 5 years. So I think that's the issue to watch out for. Are people buying houses purely for speculative capital gains? If that were to occur on a widespread scale, I think that would raise a number of issues. And for those who followed the Reserve Bank board minutes closely, you'd see that at the board we have discussed in principle how macroprudential policy would work in Australia.
Okay, I think we've got a question here from Greg Tanzer.
Philip, in your speech, I remember that you may mention that superannuation funds have a need for liquidity that might inhibit the extent to which they can directly invest in long-term assets. And I think you hinted that perhaps that's an area of policy that we could look a bit more. And I was wondering if you had any, if you wanted to unpack that at all.
Yeah. Well, many super funds say that they would like to buy corporate securities and they would like to buy infrastructure-related assets. But one of the things that inhibits them doing that is that they need to keep a large stock of liquid assets in case their unit holders decide to move to another super fund. That ability to move between super funds has been allowed for sound public policy reasons. It presumably increases competition and gives people choice. But I think one consequence of it is that it does place a greater premium on illiquid assets. They are less attractive to hold. And at some level, it seems, as I said in my remarks, slightly curious that people are putting money away for 20, 30, 40 years, and the very vast bulk of people don't switch very often. But superannuation funds are holding very high liquid assets and require a significant premium to buy the illiquid assets. I'm not sure what the right solution is. But I think it should be on our collective radar screen to see if there is a better way of somehow locking in funds or reducing the liquidity premium that superannuation funds require on these illiquid assets. I don't know what the issue is, but I don't know what the solution is, but I think it's an issue that we collectively need to look at, and obviously it'll be part of the financial system inquiry.
I think we've got a follow-on question from Greg Medcraft.
Bill, thanks for your speech. It was very good. A topic close to my heart, actually. I was thinking laterally whether, you know, given the structural limitations on the Australian superannuation funds to, you know, the structural disincentive for them to invest in illiquid bonds, whether you've given any consideration to the idea that perhaps with the United States, you know, we signed a free trade agreement in 2007 just before the crisis. And ASIC, we signed an MOU with the SEC back then. We've never actually done anything under it. I guess one of my thoughts is whether, in fact, with debt capital markets, whether, in fact, you know, exploring a passporting arrangement whereby it would be basically open to U.S. issuers to issue easily into this market, and equally Australian issuers to issue into the U.S. market and investors, could be a better lateral solution, because it would seem to me that on the investor side, investors, say self-managed super funds, would get access to a market that is deeply liquid, has duration, where they can take duration risk, different credit risk, more diversity perhaps in the economy. And then on the other side, for Australian issuers, again, if you could actually have essentially a very seamless flow between Australia and America for issuers, smaller issuers, with a deeper market, longer duration, perhaps more credit intensive, this would seem to me perhaps a game changer that perhaps we're looking for, where, you know, we could actually get that free flow between us and the US debt capital markets, which, you know, is the biggest debt capital market in the world. So just a, I guess, a lateral thought, perhaps, whether you've actually contemplated that one at all.
You know a lot more about this topic than I do, so I've just prefaced my remarks with that comment. But what you're saying, I see, is part of building this infrastructure that would support a stronger corporate bond market. I'm not convinced that it's kind of a magic bullet, though, because I think kind of the big overlay here is that the Australian banking sector, it's highly rated. It can raise funds relatively cheaply and lend those to the corporate sector. Now, some corporates, but not very many, can do that more cheaply than our banks. And while it's only a relatively few companies that can do it, the corporate bond market I don't think is ever going to be that vibrant. It's where you see vibrancy in the corporate bond market is where the banks, either their own cost of funding is very high or they don't want to lend. And I think that's the kind of overlay. And so we shouldn't, in my own view, we shouldn't lament too long the fact that our corporate bond market is not as vibrant as it is somewhere else, because it's a sign of health of our banking system. But we should still work on these infrastructure issues that you've identified.
Well, I think the only issue is that, you know, with the change in banking regulations, particularly the liquidity ratio, you know, the banks are quite challenged because of the liquidity ratio in terms of obviously advancing for long duration. So I do think, if you want, again, there's quite a structural incentive in there for banks to try and get probably their corporate customers to go into the bond market. So I think you've got a bit of a game changer in that there is an incentive now for long duration probably to enter the capital market. So I think, but I agree with you, it's not a single bullet. I think it's a matter of building alternative solutions, I agree.
Because the super sector and other holders of these securities require a premium for the lack of liquidity. But the person on the other side, that is the borrower, doesn't want to pay the premium for the lack of liquidity, because liquidity doesn't really matter. They don't really care about liquidity. And so there's this kind of mismatch. So somehow I think improving liquidity of the bonds or making the super sector, coming up with a set of arrangements in which the super sector is less desirous of liquidity would also help.
I think that's why I'm attracted to the US capital markets, though, because there you've got credit investors that actually quite like a lack of liquidity, because they're buying for 10, 20, 30 years. They don't have a liquidity issue, but they appreciate the credit quality. So that's why, just thinking laterally, I think that's something that probably should be explored a little more. That's all. A better match.
Yep, I agree.
Well, I think we've got one last question, I guess, to the gentleman over there, and then I think we probably should wrap up.
Hi, my name is Akash Devkar. I'm from Promontory. Just on the liquidity side, my question to Dr. Lowe is, would products like liquidity swaps that were designed in the UK but subsequently prohibited by the Bank of England would be the way to solve the liquidity problem? So, for example, you could have a superannuation fund investing in a corporate bond, but they can actually structure a swap so they can actually access a liquidity from the banks. And would RBA actually support those sort of products going forward?
Well, that would be a private sector initiative, I presume, with banks providing those type of facilities to the superannuation sector. So, if that emerged, I think that would be a sensible development. The issue, I think, is that these things come at a cost, and someone has to pay ultimately. So, if you can move the provider of liquidity to someone who's more naturally inclined to do it, there may be gains from trade between various private sector entities. But it's not an issue that the central bank would be directly involved in.